She see money all around me. I look like I'm the man. Yeah, but I was down and out like last week. Tell me, where have you been?
Denim Brown, three to go. Denim Brown, 4-3. No good. By George, the dream is alive.
Welcome to another episode of By George, featuring PD Buckets. Follow him on Twitter at PD Buckets.
Hey, what's going on, everybody?
So thankfully, we've added Pete to the staff. Last year, he did some writing for us on our website, and we decided he needed a bigger platform. You can now find him at giantkiller.co, but he covered for us. Why? Because Chris got married.
What an idiot.
So now By George is married, both of us. So I was in his wedding, did all the festivities, golf, but we missed two games. So Petey stepped up. I want to talk a little bit about your first experience with Press Row and just kind of, you know, getting that media pass and walking in there with a different feel than being a fan.
Sure. First, Press Row is an experience, man. It's a real sensory overload. There's just so much going on. I think the one thing that I didn't realize was that your view is not as good, probably as the season ticket holders have. In my season tickets, I'm a couple rows up off of the floor, and it gives you a nice view kind of down onto the floor. When you're on Press Row and you're on court level, your view just gets obstructed by everything. So it's like other players, the referees get in your way for the Cal State Northridge game.
All I heard
game.
From that, Petey, was that you're bawling. You're sitting half court.
Yeah.
Is that an upgrade? Have you been sitting there for a while?
It's my second year there. And I mean, it shouldn't surprise anybody that I spend too much time and money on Mason basketball, right?
Yeah, you're rolling back there in the gold room having halftime beers. Must be nice.
Well, not when I'm sitting on Press Row. I got to give that up then.
So tell me this. Did you eat the food?
Yes, I did. And I survived. But when you're sitting on Press Row, the other thing is that I was sitting behind the opposing bench both games, and Reggie Theus is Cal State's coach is huge, and he just totally blocked my view of a few different plays that Mason was running.
Right.
So in the first half of the Mason Cal State game, there was just a ton of stuff that I missed just because Reggie Theus is so freaking big, and I was sitting behind him for the entire first half.
Actually looked like there was a lot of people on Press Row this time.
Yeah, Mason's generating some interest. I think, Dick Patrick was there. Patrick Stevens was at both games. Sorry, I say Dick Patrick was there. Like, that's a surprise, right?
Yeah.
Patrick Stevens was there for both games. He's a local guy who covers a lot of Hoyas, a lot of Maryland basketball. So I thought it was interesting that he was there. I think SiriusXM was at the Binghamton game. Wasn't totally sure why, but... Press Row is an event, man. There's just like there's so much going on, and I gained a totally new level of respect for people who do that and people who sit there every game. Yeah.
So I don't want to give you advice on air, but next time just roam around to where, like, if you need to move over because the coach is too big, then you got to, I'm assuming there were seats available. So.
There were. I didn't want to get yelled at,
So let's talk a little bit. I was kind of bitter that I missed both games, but, for good reason. So tell me a little bit about them. I've been trying to look for film, but mostly just watching, a couple highlights.
Yeah. So I think the thing that I took out of both games is that Binghamton and Cal State are both teams that were bigger than we are. And I think, once again, this Mason team is going to do a really good job of mitigating any size disadvantage that we have. I think Binghamton in particular had two really good bigs, Thomas Bruce, who's a local guy, went to DeMatha, and then Willie Rodriguez, who's from Florida. Both of those guys were just a lot bigger. Willie Rodriguez in particular isn't really tall. He's 6'6", but he's just a big body. And Binghamton was trying to go inside over and over and over again in the first half, and to a large extent it was working, and same extent with Cal State.
So would you say that from what you've seen from Marr, why does he defend well? Is it his length?
I wrote a little bit about this in the weekly rundown, but
that you can find at giantkiller.co.
Giantkiller.co, right, thank you. Marr is just one of those guys who's savvy beyond his years at this point, right? Like,
He does look like he has a nice old man game.
He's undersized when he's playing the five, right? And so his ability to defend the five without fouling is something that's just really, really impressive. I think we knew we were getting a polished offensive player, right? He played for the national team in the Capital Classic. He had this really impressive resume and pedigree coming out of high school. And I think at the same time, while that's all really impressive, generally the place where freshmen struggle the most is defense. So you would expect Gonar to be getting picked on a little bit, being an undersized guy who's guarding fives who are much bigger than he is. And in the case of Thomas Bruce, Thomas Bruce is a senior.
Bigs have put up numbers, though, right? Did they not get points?
They put up numbers, but I mean, I think the thing that stuck out to me, like, I think Thomas Bruce got his. I'm not looking at his exact line right now, but Gonar forced him into a couple bad shots in the second half, and I think it's partially positioning, it's partially length, and it's partially, you know, athleticism. But more, as much as anything, it's just sort of a mental game and sort of the ability to understand, you know, what your opponent's going to react to and what your opponent's not going to react to.
So that first game, Binghamton, that was close down to the stretch, right?
Yeah, I think Mason started pulling away with around 10 minutes left in the second half, I think. Mason was losing 38-32 at the half, and then we won like 69-57, I think, something like that. So I gave up 38 points in the first.
Right, both games we gave up points in the first, right?
Yeah, so Mason gave up, I think, 38 points in the first and 19 points in the second half to Binghamton, and something similar against Cal State.
And I think that's kind of like, you know, the better team clamping down. You know, basketball is a game of runs. Maybe it takes us a little bit of time.
Yeah, I was a little bit. I asked Dave in the Binghamton presser, and that was me popping my cherry in pressers and asking my first question. You know, which can be intimidating. But you know, I asked him what they did differently in the second half of the Binghamton game, and he said that schematically they didn't do anything different. And I don't know how much I believe that, but I couldn't. If they did do anything different, you know, I couldn't really pick it out. But he said that schematically they didn't do anything different. He said that basically college basketball, the margins are just razor thin. So if you're, you know, if you let up even a little bit, your opponent's going to look really good for a half. And then when you clamp down,
right,
you know, things can go the other way. So he credited it more to intensity and focus in the second half than anything else.
And then the second game that went into overtime, I can't believe I missed it because, I mean,
you missed a great one.
I've been sicing AJ forever since I saw him shooting jumpers when I would go to practice last year and just kind of watch him. And it's like, I wanted to see that breakout game so bad.
You went and watched him at Kenner League a few times this year.
Yeah. I was definitely.
So what did you see at Kenner then?
At Kenner, it's like a fast paced game all the time. So you just got to watch AJ run the floor, play transition basketball, explode, get tip backs, and you can see that's why early on he has a couple already where he's have offensive goaltending because he loves that follow tip in play. That's where he's coming in, and when he perfects it early on, freshman's going to make a couple mistakes. You can't even stop him because you want that rim protection, as you probably saw last game, that the guy can play around the rim. And so in help side defense, like man-to-man, he may get burned a little bit, and that's what you saw in Kenner. Like, he wasn't the best at maybe boxing his guy out, but anytime he could clean up on both the defensive board or getting blocks.
When he's coming over from the weak side, you're saying?
Correct. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I think we got to see some of that, and I actually want to hear a little bit more about it.
So I think you saw AJ live his best life against Cal State Northridge, right? I think if you weren't there, it's kind of tough to explain the setting because I think in a vacuum, it's like we beat Cal State Northridge, right?
Big deal? But did a student show up?
The students showed up, man.
They went at least like three quarters up the student section.
You know, I'm one of those people who doesn't super pay attention to the students.
I need that next time, Petey. I need that next time.
All right, sorry.
And then what about like season ticket holders? Was there at least like?
Yeah, there was a good crowd.
Okay, so it wasn't like we were playing in front of no one.
No. Crowd was good. Right. And I also want to shout out Doc Nix and the Green Machine, because I got there a little bit early for the women's game, and I didn't realize that the Green Machine was going ham for the women's game beforehand.
Right.
And, you know, I think they got a 45-minute break-in after the women's game ended, and then they were out there going nuts even before the men's game started again.
So real quick, because now you're taking me down rabbit holes.
Right.
Did you get a chance to watch Natalie Butler play? Did you actually watch the girls' game?
I watched the second half of the girls'
game.
You
did.
As impressive as Natalie Butler is, the girls were actually dropping threes. I think they played Southeastern Missouri State,
freshman point guard, I believe.
J.C. Bolton.
Yeah,
J.C. Bolton can play. There was another freshman that was hitting threes. I forget her name. But yeah, the girls' team looks legit, man. And then Natalie Butler is like, as a 6'5 center, I don't think you see a lot of those
coming
in the
from
women's
UConn,
basketball level.
Back at Georgetown, she put up a ton of points. So she went to Lake Braddock. I went to Lake Braddock, so I've been watching her play for a long time.
Right.
I'm actually going to try to make it to a couple girls' games this year.
Yeah.
So for the women who hit up By George and say, we don't talk about you, you just got a 2-minute plug in our episode. Let's get back to AJ throwing blocks into the crowd.
I think before we finish that, I think I'll actually go back to a women's game, actually, because it was, it's generally not really something that I pay attention to, just being totally honest, but, you know, it was fun. And anytime you watch one team dominate another, it's a cool experience. But J.C. Bolton can play, Natalie Butler can play. I'm sorry I'm forgetting the other girls' names, but the women's team has some juice behind it this year. So AJ Wilson, sorry.
It's okay.
I think that you need to set the stage, and you kind of can't. If you weren't there, it's kind of tough to explain how this overtime victory at home against Cal State Northridge is actually a big deal. But team is totally flat in the first half. Jair hurts his leg towards the end of the first half. I think five of AJ had 8 blocks, and I think 5 of them came in the first half. And even with that, we were down by, I think, 8 or 10 at halftime. And
so the 5 blocks, are they like are they like massive like swats? Are they just like quick tips from behind? Like, are they all of the above? Like, I'm just trying to picture.
So when you block 8 shots, that's the nice thing about blocking 8 shots is that you get a variety. It's sort of like a variety pack of different blocks. I think he swatted a couple into the student section and into the stands. And then he also had a couple sort of tip blocks that led to runouts, which are obviously really helpful because they generate like really easy transition baskets. But, you know, in a vacuum, an overtime victory at home against Cal State Northridge isn't the most impressive thing. But I think when you take into the context that the team looked flat, it looked like it might be a letdown game because, you know, everybody on the team is flying to Cancun the day after, you know, so maybe they're not taking Cal State Northridge.
And they're living the life, man. They're ordering, like, room service every night.
Oh, yeah.
I've been
keeping up with the tweets, man. They're they're enjoying themselves, as they should be. But, yeah, and then Jair gets hurt. And so Jair gets hurt, and we're down by 11, I think, at one point in the second half was the biggest deficit. And I'll be really honest, like, things did not look good. And I don't think that we win that game unless AJ comes off the bench and goes nuclear. So it's not just the...
Then he hit 2 threes?
He hit 2 threes. He was two for three from distance.
Did he go to the line at all?
2 threes were super smooth. I don't think he shot any free throws. But
he's a good free throw shooter too. Like, as soon as he starts attacking the bucket even more,
so you can tell he's got a good jumper. On offense, he made some savvy cuts to the basket. I think he had 12 points. I think two of his field goals were dunks. Another was a layup.
Tell me this, Pete.
Yeah.
When's the last time you saw a dunk off an inbounds at the Patriots or at Eagle Bank Arena? Because I can't think of a single time under the Paulson era. Was it just
I don't think it was in the Paulson era. I don't know.
Just like catch dunk off of an offensive play. Like, we really don't get too much offensive scoring. Like, it was the first pass on the inbounds. Like, that doesn't happen that often. The reason it does is because he can fly.
Yeah, you know, and yeah, he totally showed that. I think the last time I probably saw it at all that I can remember off the top of my head was Luke Hancock. But
heck yeah, going baseline.
Yeah, Hancock did that baseline dipsy do a whole lot.
Yeah, I mean,
That was always fun. But no, AJ, I think the 8 blocks is sort of the eye-popping stat that everybody talks about, myself included. But, you know, AJ hits 2 threes. His threes pull his defender out of the paint. I think I said something similar about Mar. Like, when Mar is hitting from outside the perimeter, what you're doing at that point is you're pulling a big out of the paint and you're creating space for your guards to go to the rim. So I think that the importance of playing guys like Mar and AJ together on the floor at the same time, who can pull those bigs out of the paint and who can create space for guys like Otis to create, you know, that the importance of that is really tough to overstate. I think AJ also had a couple steals. I think one of the things that I like to do from a stats perspective is just kind of to combine blocks and steals and get an overall idea of a guy's impact on defense, mm-hmm. especially a guy with the same body type as AJ, who's like, he's 6'7", you know, he might be a steal specialist, he might be a block specialist, could kind of do either. But when you add in the 2 steals, he had 8 blocks and 2 steals. That's just a destructive defensive force, right? Like when you're playing against a guy who can do that to your team, it's going to be tough to score points. And I think Cal State Northridge went 8 for 28 in the second half. And overtime when AJ was playing most of his minutes.
And you can see that we do a pretty good job closing out too. So like mm-hmm. that's one thing that, you know, and anybody who follows me knows that I hate on the lack of size, especially in a defense in a weak side setting. But one thing, you know, that I think that Dave has done a very good job of is really getting his players to buy into the closeout, to have quick feet. Just to always make sure that their hands are out. And, you know, you can look much bigger than you are if you just do all those little things. And I think that also helps AJ clean up. Just knowing that if other people are in their spots, then we can have a couple guys kind of roam around in the back of a defense. And so one thing you said is that Dave talked about a matchup zone. I know mm-hmm. that. Did you get a chance to really see it at all? Or
no, Dave mentioned it in the presser, and then I was kind of kicking myself because if we played a matchup zone, I missed it. I'm guessing it wasn't for more than a few possessions, but
because the matchup zone is intriguing to me, especially, you know, for our like for people like we don't want to allow our players to get too tired during a game,
right?
And so that kind of keeps you in a spot. Yeah, you got to play hard, but you're not running and following a guy right. from corner to corner.
And it also prevents your Otis Livingstons from getting switched onto you know the Tavrio Dawsons or Tavrion right. Dawson. I think Tavrion Dawson was the name of Cal State's best player, who was pretty big and who was, you know, murdering us for a lot of the game. I think that the nice thing about having an eraser in the back line like AJ, and I wrote about this in my A10 preview, but when you have a guy who can block shots anchoring the back of your defense, it just makes so much of your defense better
right.
because you can press on the perimeter in that mm-hmm. case.
And say with that lineup that you got to see, AJ, and then you have Mar, and Mar can legitimately at this point, for a lot of the teams that we're going to play, he can guard the 1 through 5.
Mar is so good, man.
So when you have AJ that can play that kind of back spot, you can actually shift Mar up to something that he's actually more like, you know, that's actually more appealing to be able to have him in that like next layer, kind of playing on the outside but also coming in on the inside. You know, I think it just kind of, it will allow him to like get some steals, get his length out there. I don't know. He just always seems properly positioned to me. So putting him and AJ together has to get us excited. But
so I think you're thinking the same thing that I'm thinking. That is, if first of all, we hope Jair is okay. Second of all, if Jair is not okay, I think your thought immediately becomes what's the starting lineup then? And then you sort of talk yourself into a starting lineup of Otis, Kyer, Boyd, and then Mar playing the 4 and Wilson playing the 5. And that's a right. fun lineup to think about because Mar's been playing the 5 most of the season, and I think he's really going to benefit from not being the main big on the floor and having somebody anchoring the defense behind him.
Yeah, especially because I think what we saw in – so granted, I'm just doing this by watching as much as I can from, like, Mason's Instagram vids and stuff like that, but – we saw him score a little bit more in the paint, cutting, going back door. He had a nice little finger roll in front of the rim that I saw.
Yep.
So that's what happens when you start to hit your outside shots. People all of a sudden yell 3 when you're shooting. If you have a shot fake and, you know, in a one dribble move to get to the bucket, he can actually end up really benefiting from AJ being able to step out and hit some jumpers, because now we're going to see Mar's game is versatile. It goes, well, you know, and, all spots on the court.
And the spacing is going to be great, too, because I think if you see the bucket where Mar scored the tying basket to send us to overtime, I think what you see is five guys outside the perimeter, and you see five defenders who are pretty close to the three-point line as well. So Mar gets a step on his man, and then it's game over because nobody's catching him between the foul line and in the rim there. So I think that, you know, offensively we're going to be able to pressure the defense in different ways. Our spacing last year with Marquise Moore and Jalen Jenkins was bad because Jair and Otis were really the only legitimate three-point threats that were on the court a whole lot. I think Kyer had a good percentage, but he was generally only shooting threes when he was wide open. Otis this week demonstrated the ability a few times to hit some step back threes off the dribble when the shot clock was winding down, which is just something where as a defender, there's really not much you can do about it. You just got to force him into a bad shot and hope he doesn't hit it. But I'm excited about the implications this has on sort of how we're able to space the floor and how much sort of, you know, how much each player is going to be able to try and exploit individual matchups.
Right. I mean, if I can be honest, Grayer, be injured right now. Okay? Spend your time. Right. Like, enjoy your rehab.
Get nice and healthy for A-10 play.
Kick it in Mexico. Holler at some shorties. Like, I don't care.
Right.
I just need you back at some point. I do like that we can kind of see different lineups when someone is hurt. The one thing I'm still worried about, though, I haven't really heard much from Kyer, because in that Binghamton game, he balled, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yep.
And he showed his ability to get to the bucket and be creative off the dribble. So What happened to him in the second game?
I think it's a little bit of how he was being defended. I think that Cal State Northridge threw a lot more zone at us than Binghamton did. They both played a fair amount of zone, but my read on it was that Cal State Northridge is playing this zone that kind of discouraged driving and encouraged jump shooting, and Kyer didn't really have the same kind of lanes that he likes to try and exploit. So he's a little bit more passive. I think if you look at his line, which I don't have in front of me right now, I don't think he took a ton of shots. So I think it was more of a case of him trying to step back and trying to create for other players like Mar and like AJ, who had good matchups and who were producing on offense, rather than trying to force some shots himself.
This whole time you're talking, I just still can't believe that I missed AJ's performance. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it's just like, we put him as our game day. We put the bench. They're all like, they're holding arms, you know, like it's getting a ton of retweets. I'm like so excited for these freshmen. And I think people that are listening think that, like, because I talked a lot about like them not scoring any points in the first couple games, thought that I was like hating on the freshmen. No, I've been sizing these guys since day one.
They were also liking the tweets. I think they were giving us some snarky likes when we were talking about Mason's bench being outscored and everything like that.
Of course, they
were using it for motivation, you know, whichever is cool.
Yeah.
But
no, at one time, yeah, like only two of them, like, but my only two likes were Green and AJ. And I was like, am I doing them like a disservice?
I tweeted something about the bench being outscored 45-0 through the first two games, and then Javon and AJ both liked it, and then I immediately felt bad, you know?
So before we move on from AJ, is there anything else that he did that I missed?
Yeah, so I actually was able to catch up with AJ after the game. This is me getting my feet wet in the world of walking up to players after, you know, the best performance of their lives and asking them questions. So
I mean, you do just kind of throw yourself in, right? I mean, like, we don't have experience. Like, I'm not a journalist. I didn't major in journalism.
I don't major in journalism. I don't even coach basketball, man. I just pretend like I know what I'm talking about.
No, Petey's a baller, man. In high school, that guy was throwing it down.
Yeah. Yeah, sure I was. But no, you know, part of being media, which is pretty cool, is like you can walk around and talk to people after the games. Saw AJ walking around, asked if we could have a couple minutes with him. And so I think the first thing that I asked him was just sort of what he saw out there, you know, how he got comfortable and when he really felt like it was his game. And I really liked his answer.
All right, here it is.
AJ, big game tonight. 12 points, 8 blocks, 4 rebounds, 2 steals, I think. Definitely a breakout game. Can you tell us sort of when you knew it was your game and how you felt out there?
I never knew it was my game. I was just trying to do everything to keep my team going because my energy kind of dipped going towards the end of the first half. So I just knew whatever I can do, especially blocking shots and just yelling and stuff like that, will bring energy to the team. So whatever opportunity I saw to block a shot to bring energy to the team, that's what I had to do.
Yeah. Hit a couple threes. I think that was part of your game that we saw at Kenner League, something you haven't tried yet this season. What gave you the confidence to take those?
We just had to hit into a flow of offense. You know, the energy was there. I feel like it wasn't any forced shots. It was just like in the flow, and it just found me. They were both wide open, so I feel like that was like a proper time to shoot. Just happened to go in.
All right, awesome. Well, thanks a lot, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, see you around.
Awesome interview, by the way.
Thank you.
How did you record it?
Our buddy Ron, a.k.a. Ibrahim, held his iPhone up to AJ's face. I really only thought of the first question, and this is what I talk about when I say it's actually more difficult than I thought it was. I thought of one question. Then I asked it to AJ. Then he answered it. Then I realized I didn't have a follow-up question. So I sort of stumbled through the follow-up question. Then he answered that one. And then I was like, all right, thanks, AJ.
Yeah.
Good. You did great.
It is tough.
I need some work.
But it is tough, too, because, like, they're also young kids. So, you know, like, no one is necessarily professional. So it makes it easier. But at the same time, it's their answers may not be, like, good, or they not be like may not like be used to like getting questioned after the biggest game their lives.
I was super impressed though. AJ is very polished. Gonar is very polished. Otis is really polished. All of them, like Otis and Gonar, are the ones who did the post game presser with Paulson. And you know, Otis came up and shook everybody's hand after the Cal State Northridge game. So it's like those guys are just. They're so far ahead of probably where you could reasonably expect them to be right now.
Right. So when you asked a question, did you say I am Pete from anything?
I said Pete from By George before the first one.
Did you?
I didn't say.
Thanks for the rap.
I gave you guys the shout out.
You can't do it more than once. I mean, you can't. Like sometimes I do, but like at this point, Dave's like, Brian, I know you. Like so, the last time he came in. I don't know. Who was our first game? Lafayette. He came in and he was like, does anyone have stats? And it's like me and Dick Patrick, and Dick Patrick doesn't have stats. And I'm like,
Patrick handed Otis his stats because he saw Otis trying to peek at Dave's stats.
Oh, that was nice. So I did the same exact thing first time for Dave.
Yeah.
So at this point, I can't be like, I'm Brian from By George over and over again, but thanks for repping us. So Pete, first, like, I know I just said thank you, but, you know, you did an awesome job. We're watching from afar, like Chris and I, because, like,
it's fun, man.
We're handing over, like, our baby, you know, to, like, two guys that, like, we don't really know that well, honestly. Like, we brought on Petey because Chris read the boards. I was never really a board guy, but Chris was always on it. And Chris was like, man, this guy Petey is changing the boards. He's talking about advanced stats. He's doing this. He's doing that. I think Chris thought he was the stat guy until, like, you came around. And then we hit you up, and you've come on, and now you're going to take on more going forward.
Hell yeah.
But there's a couple things that I don't think we've touched on before we let you go.
Sure.
Ian Boyd, how did he look in both games? I know in that first game he had 10 points in the first half, and it just kind of seems like he can score whenever he wants to himself.
Yeah.
I know you're high on him.
Yeah, so I've always loved Ian Boyd. That's no surprise. I think this season his deep ball is not quite coming along the way we want it to yet. I think he's 3-for-14 from three to start the season. Not super worried about it. Reason is that he's been fantastic in the mid-range game and getting to the hoop. So one of the things I was looking for from both him and Kyer that I've really been impressed with is they've been putting the ball on the ground and they've been getting to the basket. I think last year with Marquise and Jalen doing so much scoring in isolation, they were both afforded the opportunity to be a little bit more passive on offense, and they can't do that this year, and still expect Mason to be competitive, and they've risen to the challenge in a really big way. So I think the deep ball will come there from Ian, from Ian. He's 12-for-18 from two right now, and that's pretty impressive to hit two out of three shots that you take inside the arc.
Oh, heck
and it's,
yeah.
It's a testament to...
He's also hit a couple threes, right?
He's 3 for 14, yeah. So he's hit a few threes, and he's hit a few big threes, too. I think he hit one or two in the second half against Louisville that were pretty big. I might be making that up, but I'm not sure. But, yeah, so and it's not just layups either. He's also showed some real touch in the mid-range, too, where he's got to, you know, he's getting into the paint, but then he's got to stop and loft up a floater. Those are going in. So I've been pretty very impressed and pleased with that part.
I'm interested to see a lineup, and I know it's happened, but that Kyer, Boyd, and then insert anyone else from the 3-4-5, but that, yep, Kyer, Boyd, and then anybody else when – I mean, that just there's a lot of size
just
in there.
A legitimate big lineup, you're saying?
Yeah, and it's just, and it's also just like, so Kyer has told me, and you can go and look back, you know, through our tweets at By George GMU for we interview Kyer all the time. But he told me he prefers to pass first. So he wants, yep, to get his teammates involved, and you can see it. And I told him straight up to his face, I was like, you know, we need you to score buckets. So like, because there was a couple times that I've seen where he dished it off before, you know, just so kind of going up with it.
Is Coach Brian taking the credit for Kyer's improved offense this season?
I mean, when I saw him score 17, I missed it. I was like, dang, man. So I missed Kyer and AJ, and I talked to them a lot. Like, I interviewed AJ in length, and I talked to him. Yeah. I saw him at Kenner all the time. So those two guys, like, to miss them both kind of popping off, I was saddened. But
yep, as you should be.
But yeah, what were Boyd's numbers? Like, I don't even know, like, what he did in both games.
So I think the Binghamton game, I know both Boyd and Kyer were quiet in the Cal State Northridge game, and that was part of the reason that the game felt like it wasn't.
But Boyd still played, right?
Oh yeah, Boyd played.
Was he impactful?
Boyd played almost the whole damn game.
Right, that's why I was surprised to hear. Like, I assumed he scored 8 when we were talking earlier, okay. But
Boyd played 27 minutes against Cal State Northridge. He scored 6 points. He was 1 of 3 from the field. So he wasn't really looking to shoot a whole lot. I think he was 0-for-1 from 3. He hit 1 field goal, but he was 4-for-4 from the line. You know, he had 5 rebounds. It wasn't an impact game for Ian Boyd, but that's okay. You know, he'll have some. I think that's part of the beauty of playing the lineup style that Mason does, is that it's not going to be, you know, it's not all on Ian Boyd's shoulders the same way it's not on, you know, Justin Kyer's shoulders, right, to be the scorer, to
and
be
Ian
the impact
Boyd,
player.
I think Ian Boyd could be one of those kind of spark plug guys, as long as when he's on the court he's still, like, getting rebounds and playing good defense, yeah, and impacting the game in other ways. I think that we'll see plenty of halves where Ian Boyd just puts up 10 points and kind of has 3 straight buckets.
And I think he's going to be one of those guys where you're not really always going to be able to look at the box score and measure exactly what the impact that Ian Boyd had on the game. He gets pretty tough defensive assignments. You know, he's right up there with Jair in terms of we ask him to guard guys that are a lot bigger than he is.
Right.
So I think he's been doing a great job with that to this point in his career. I'm really excited to see if he can kind of wreak havoc using his size and using his sort of football player frame to keep smaller guards off the perimeter, to sort of run people off the line, to keep people out of the paint. I think there's a lot of potential for him to do that, and we haven't really been able to see it simply because we ask him to, you know, we ask him to guard opposing power forwards all the time.
There it is, Petey's bucket of knowledge. Okay. Real quick, we're gonna transition over to A-10 talk. If you're a Mason fan and you don't care about the A-10, go ahead and turn us off. I wouldn't recommend it because we're gonna be playing all these teams soon, and PD is breaking down legitimately every team in the A-10. But before we go to a quick break, just want to let everybody know that I talked to Doc Nix. Okay, and so PD gave him a little shout out. And at opening night, I talked to him a little bit about if we could actually bring our poll to life that we've had on our Twitter so many times of suggesting songs and seeing if we can get one of them played. It appears that the number one issue is that you got to pay for the rights of that song. So if the song's popular, if you're talking about like a Kanye, yeah, West song, we're talking about $2,000, something in that range.
Are we going to open up a Kickstarter?
Right. Yeah. So I'm thinking, like, you got to pay, like, you know, pay $2 to vote or something. And it goes straight towards the Green Machine. So this is all going to come together here in the next couple of months. Just know that Doc Nix and I are talking about a fan vote to add a song for after the holiday break. Stay tuned for some A10 talk.
Looking at the world is not inspiring, it's intimidating. And I'm standing here, yeah, I'm standing here, and I'm just waiting. Waiting till the time is right, is what we're saying.
This episode is brought to you by Valaccio. What is Valaccio? It's a watch company. One of my former players bought a watch company, is now pushing it all over Northern Virginia, nationwide. Where can you find them? Valaccio.com. That's VALACHIO.com. Again, that's one of my former players. He's 19 years old, goes to UVA, bought a watch company, and it looks sharp. My favorite part is the hands of the watch are a different color. Sometimes it matches the band, but most of the time it just pops off the face. Again, that's Valaccio.com. Welcome back to By George. Next segment up, A10 Hierarchy, featuring Petey Buckets. Follow him on Twitter at Petey Buckets. Petey, kick it off for us. Who's the 14th best team in the A10?
Oh, we're going bottom from top today, are we?
Bottom to the top.
All right. So these rankings were submitted last night before today's games. And as of last night, I actually had Richmond as the worst team in the A-10. They beat what's supposed to be a pretty good UAB team today, so this will change next week. But through their first two games, they were one of the absolute worst defensive teams in the country. They had 126 D rating. I think it was actually a little bit worse than that. Offensively, they were scoring 92.5 points per 100 possessions. They didn't just get murdered in their first two games. They got murdered by two pretty bad teams, Delaware and Jacksonville State. So, yeah, I know they get Quan Four back at
Delaware?
Some point. Delaware and Jacksonville State, who I think is just as worthy of that sort of, you know, incredulous emphasis as Delaware is.
And I saw this white guy, this, like, white scruffy guy that I couldn't imagine playing basketball bald today.
Yeah, that's Grant Golden. I think he's going to be pretty good for him. I mean, he's going to have to be. But yeah, I think at least until today, they were too bad to rank any higher because those two season opening losses that they had were just horrible. So they were number 14 to start for me.
Number 13.
Lucky number 13 was Fordham. Their only win was against LIU Brooklyn. LIU Brooklyn was picked to finish sixth in the Northeastern Conference, which is not very good. They had a pretty horrible offensive rating of 84.8, worst in the A-10 by far. They only scored 43 points when they played Florida State. And what's even worse for them is that their best player, Joseph Chartouni.
Charcuterie.
Joseph Charcuterie.
Mason's going to eat him up.
That's correct. He looks like he might have regressed a little bit. He only had 5 points in the loss to Tulane. I think he's averaging around 4 steals a game.
That's right. When he got Freshman of the Year, I was so blown.
Yeah. So aside from the steals per game number, which is really gaudy because of Fordham's sort of insane trap and press scheme, his numbers are down across the board. And I think if you were banking on Fordham to exceed expectations, it was going to be because Chartouni took another step forward. And
Charcuterie,
sorry. And that's definitely not happened so far.
Number 12.
Duquesne has actually been the pleasant surprise of the A-10. They won pretty comfortably against St. Francis and VMI. Those two teams aren't very good, but, you know, compared to where I expected Duquesne to be at the beginning of the season, it was nice to see them win both those games by 10-plus points. The thing about Duquesne is that their out-of-conference schedule is really, really soft. I was looking through it, and I don't think there's a single team on there that you would say lets you know kind of who Duquesne is going to be. So we're really not going to know a whole lot about how good they actually are before A-10 play.
So this is like kind of like entering into your mind a fringe surprise in the A-10 or no?
No, I think it's probably more likely that they're going to be one of those teams with a pretty decent win-loss record before A-10 play starts, like 7-5 or something like that, and then they might get squished in A-10 play. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you can get the check. Yeah, thank you.
So, as you heard, we are at a bar in Shirlington recording A-10 Hierarchy.
You can't edit this part out and make it feel less sad.
No. No. We're having a couple brews together.
Come on. Yeah.
And can we just get... Okay, so Duquesne bombed number 11.
Duquesne hasn't bombed. Duquesne, I think they lost today, but Duquesne's fine. I like Duquesne. Number 11, George Washington. Yuta Watanabe, he's their most important player. He's destructive defensively. He's got eight rebounds, almost three blocks, and almost a steal per game. When you look at those sort of numbers, that just sort of instantly tells you that that's a guy who's changing the game on the defensive end. But offensively, he's just not super efficient at this point, and that's a little bit disappointing. I think he's got around 13 points on 12 shots. Their two wins are against some pretty bad teams, Hampton and Howard. And then they got murdered by Florida State. One other thing about him is that they're shooting about 20.
What was that Florida State game? Do you know?
Florida State was about 20 points, I think.
Yikes.
So 24 points. But one other thing I think is noteworthy about him is that they're only shooting 27% from three this year. That's really, really bad. They haven't been over 30% in a single game that they've played.
Yikes.
So they're going to need some better three-point shooting if they're going to compete at all in the A-10.
Number 10.
Number 10 is UMass. UMass has been a little bit of a surprise this season. The Luane Pipkins just put up 34 points on 18 shots against Niagara. I actually called him out as a volume scorer in our A-10 season preview because I think he averaged 10 points on about 10 shots per game. So this is a cool development. You know, in fairness, he was a freshman last year, so he's a sophomore this year. And UMass's only loss is to Harvard in overtime, and Harvard was the Ivy League favorite. They've got a 90.8 defensive rating, so they were really good defensively last year. They're still probably pretty good on defense this year, and they also got Rashawn Holloway back a little bit earlier than they were expecting. So this is a team. They got a new coach. This is a team that might surprise some people. I started them off at the season at number 12. They moved up to number 10. You know, keep it up. Maybe they continue moving up.
And what Pete's referencing is that we participate in some A-10 Talk stuff. You can follow them on Twitter at A-10 Talk. So right now we are participating in their power rankings. And so a couple different of us, you know, we got me and Chris and Pete all contributing to their power ranking system. And so when Pete references that, that's what he's talking about.
Right. Thank you.
What number are we on?
We're on number 9.
Number 9.
Lucky number 9 is LaSalle. LaSalle's interesting because they've been testing themselves in their out-of-conference schedule. They've already played Northwestern and BC. They have Miami and Temple coming up. The problem is that they didn't beat either Northwestern or BC. And I mean, I'll be honest, I don't think they're going to beat Miami or Temple either.
Temple looks good so far.
Temple looks pretty good, man.
They're coming back home with a nice little win.
Yeah. So BJ Johnson's doing it all for LaSalle right now. He's averaging 21-10 as of the time we're recording this podcast. Pookie Powell is a guy I shouted out as a guy who was someone to watch in the A-10 this year. He's been a little bit of a volume scorer. He's got about 13 points on 13 shots through his first few games. And then the rest of the guys on LaSalle, they're not scoring very efficiently either. So this is one of those teams where I haven't seen them play yet, but just looking through the box scores, looking through the advanced stats, it looks a little bit like it's BJ Johnson, then it's Pookie Powell, and then you kind of wonder if there's anybody else on the team that you got to worry about.
Number 8.
So I've actually still got our beloved George Mason Patriots at number 8 right now. I know I just wrote
at 3-1?
at 3-1, and I just wrote a really drippy, fawning piece about how awesome these past two wins were.
And again, you can find that at giantkiller.co.
Thank you. Thank you for the plug. But yeah, so the competition has been weak, if we're keeping it real. Cal State, Northridge, Binghamton, Lafayette. The three wins are not... those are not what anybody's going to call good wins at the
end
of the year.
Meanwhile, one's in overtime and one's like a two-point bucket.
One was a two-point game that came down to the wire, and the Binghamton game, even though we won that by 12, we were trailing at the half.
Right.
So
number eight probably makes some sense.
Yeah.
Although I don't have them at eight in my personal power rankings, but, you know, this is the Petey Bucket segment.
They're number one in my heart. But number eight in the power rankings.
Number seven
is Dayton. Dayton, I think, might be the biggest faller. They, I think they're kind of underperforming their talent to an extent so far. So Daryl Davis, I don't know how to pronounce his name, has emerged as the top scorer. He's scoring over 20 points a game. Zerius Williams, who's sort of a stretch four, he's like 6'8", 220, he can hit threes. He's settled into more of a fill-up-the-box score kind of role, which obviously could change. But through their first few games, he's averaging, I think, 10 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists, 1 steal, not quite 1 block. But, he's the kind of guy who's doing a little bit of everything. And then you've got Josh Cunningham, who's averaging 15-9. And you put that all together, and they've won a nail-biter against Ball State. Then they lost to Hofstra. And then they beat Ohio. So they're 2-1. The two wins are not great wins. The loss is not a very good loss. They look a little bit underwhelming so far.
Number six.
So number six is St. Louis. St. Louis is probably one of the risers from where I had teams in the preseason. One thing that their early games have demonstrated is that the talent is legitimate. Javon Best is their Michigan State transfer. He's got 65 points on 30 field goal attempts.
And now, did he redshirt last year, or is he one of these guys that didn't play enough minutes and then ended up being able to play right away?
No, he was a transfer, so I don't think you call it a redshirt. I think he was at Michigan State 2 years ago, then he decided to transfer, so he just sat out a year.
I thought that was considered a redshirt year.
Is it? I don't think that's actually a redshirt.
Like, so what is Reuter doing right now? So that's just a transfer? It's just called like a transition year?
Yeah, is it? I don't know.
I don't know either.
I don't know. I feel like welcome to By George. We don't really know.
But either way, the guy sat out last year is what I was asking.
He sat out last year, yeah. But either way, 65 points on 30 field goal attempts is just crazy efficient. And that's through four games, so it's not, he's not going to stay there all season, but it's not necessarily a sort of fluky pace either.
Right.
Jordan Goodwin was their prized recruit. He's the best recruit to come into the A-10 this season. So for as efficient as Javon Best has been scoring, Jordan Goodwin has been as inefficient. Jordan Goodwin's got something. He's taking more shots per game than points he's averaging, which is just terrible. Like, you never want to be there. But he's also putting up 5 assists per game, 7 rebounds, 3 steals, and a block.
So it's a matter of just his shots falling.
So, I mean, he's going to be a freaking nightmare when his shot starts falling, man, because a guy who can already fill up the box score like that, those guys don't come around very often. In the preseason, I said that I wasn't really sold on St. Louis's coaching. I said their talent was legitimate, but I'm not sold on their coaching. I'm kind of still there. They won a big game against Virginia Tech. They got walloped by Providence.
What I heard from that game, from the Tech game, was that Tech missed like 12 free throws, didn't really look that good, made a lot of mental mistakes down the stretch, kind of like played down to their opponent. But maybe I'm wrong.
I mean, I think Tech's still a good team, and I think that...
They could be a top 25 team all said and done.
I think Tech's a tournament team at the end of the day, and... I don't want to diminish that win just because it was a team like St. Louis. But I think that's the kind of team that St. Louis is going to be this year. They're going to pull off some really good wins, some wins that you might not expect, but they're going to be inconsistent enough for some head scratchers. I think that's partially a function of, not sold on their coaching staff. And also, they've got a lot of guys who've never played together before, between the transfers and between the talented freshmen that they're bringing in.
I believe we only played them once this year. And I sure hope it's a W for Mason.
Right.
Number
five is St. Joe's. St. Joe's is one of those teams that's just really, you know, I don't. It's really hard to know what to make of them when you're looking at them right now. They had a really bad-looking loss to Toledo to start the year. Toledo was selected to finish third in the MAC West in the preseason. I didn't even know the MAC had two divisions, but apparently there's an East and a West, and Toledo was third in one of them. After Toledo played St. Joe's, they won an exhibition against the D2 school by 10 points. Ooh. So
wow.
Yeah, and then Lamar Kimball's out for the season, which hurts. But they've got this guy.
So why do you have him so high?
They've got this guy, Taylor Funk. He's 6'9". He's 225. He's come out of absolutely nowhere. I didn't even know who he was preseason. He's averaging 20 points per game through the first three, and he's shooting 59% for three.
Wow.
Shavar Newkirk's really good. He's had a solid start to the season. He's not lighting teams on fire like he did to start last year. But I think that when you're looking at a guy who comes off an ACL tear like Shavar Newkirk does, it's probably reasonable to expect him to get better as the season goes along and, you know, as he gets reacclimated to the game. And also Charlie Brown hasn't been playing for him. He comes back in a few weeks. So I think they've still got a good core of size and shooting when Charlie Brown comes back, and I think they've got some good lineup flexibility. They'll be able to go big. They'll be able to go small. And I think that, you know, Phil Martelli is the kind of coach who's gonna know how to utilize that, and he's going to help the team reach its potential.
Number four.
So I got some bad news. I've watched a couple of VCU games, and I think they're good again. I had them at number six to start the season. I think that was underselling them a little bit. They've got a lot of offensive firepower. They're not going to have any trouble scoring points, but they're not playing defense very well. I've watched a couple of their games. One was against North Florida. There was a point at the game where North Florida was 16 of 29 from three against them.
Is that the game where Tillman had like 27 and just balled out of control?
I think so, yeah, because North Florida has a pretty horrible defensive rating as well. But, yeah, North Florida was 16 for 29 from three, and I was watching most of that game, and it was one of those stats where it didn't feel like an accident. You know, obviously teams aren't going to shoot better than 50% from three against you over any, you know, extended period of time. But North Florida, they hit one of their last 11, so they finished 17 of 40 from three, which is still good. But, you know, VCU's got it. They've got a real problem giving up the three ball. Opponents are shooting 38% against them from three so far. That doesn't include the Marquette game that they played and lost today. Marquette was 13 for 36, so I don't think that percentage changes a whole lot. And also, one interesting thing about VCU, they're only turning over their opponent on 13.3% of possessions. That's really, really low for a pressing team. Generally,
Have they been pressing?
Oh, yeah, they've been pressing. Generally, teams that press turn the other team over around 18% at a minimum. So having them around 13.3% was really, really bad. I will say that...
Haven't they lost back-to-back games?
They lost...
I believe they lost today.
They lost to Marquette today.
And I believe they lost to UVA the game before that?
And they lost to UVA the game before that, yep.
Okay,
you're right.
So you're just going by the eye test, but you think they're good because
they were in both of those games,
they,
you know.
Were I think they? Because I didn't get a chance to watch that UVA game, but I thought they got beat up.
I didn't watch the UVA game, but I think they were within striking distance most of the game. Same thing with Marquette. They were trailing, but they were within striking distance.
And fourth in the A-10 is like, yeah, you're top four, but it still may not be like that good of a team.
Yeah.
Necessarily.
Yeah, and I also think that, you know, I think that the defensive lapses that we've seen are the kind that can be closed up by good coaching. So yep. I think
we'll find out.
We'll see. You know, I think when you press a lot like that, you'll give up some open looks.
Yeah.
Whether or not Mike Rhodes is able to close them up,
we'll see if they can ride the road.
We'll see, but I don't think it's the sort of it doesn't feel like a hopeless situation necessarily.
Number three
is St. Bonaventure. St. Bonaventure lost to Niagara in the season opener. Then they beat Jacksonville State. I had them number two preseason. It's tough to knock them down too much because they've been playing without Jalen Adams.
They've been playing without lights, right? Didn't their lights go out and they had to miss a game?
Yeah, so they didn't actually play without the lights, but they had to wait for the lights to come back on.
And they
the
never came back on, and they've since had to suspend that game, and they're looking for
I think they're playing it right now, actually.
Oh,
I think they played it today.
Oh, really?
I think the Bonnies beat the crap out of UMES,
okay,
which is the team they were playing.
Got it.
But yeah. you're right. They got no lights. They got no starting point guard. Their pets' heads are falling off.
I read the Bonnie blog, their Twitter.
Yeah, yeah.
Complete meltdown city so far.
Yeah, that was an interesting night on Twitter. But, yeah, I think the concern there is after the loss to Niagara, you're just kind of concerned, like, are the Bonnies, are they just the two-man show again? Because last year they were Matt Mobley, they were Jalen Adams, and they were not a whole lot else. And that was, you know, that was good enough to be pretty good, but it wasn't enough to get them into a team that was ever really threatening, you know, threatening for the A-10, either regular season title or conference title or even for a tournament bid, you know? And I think in the...
And they did feel like snubs last year.
I don't know if I felt like they were snubbed. I mean, I think they made the A-10 semifinal, I think.
Right.
In the A-10 tournament. But, you know.
You may have not felt that way, but they did.
Did they?
Yeah. Looking back to last year, it was all about, like, the Bonnies not making it.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think they had that goofy loss to VCU and Matt Mobley hit that shot that, or I think Matt Mobley hit a shot, but then, like their student section got a technical or something weird happened where
shocker.
Yeah.
All right, so I didn't mean, let's get back to the stats.
Sorry. Matt Mobley went nuts in their loss to Niagara, and the problem was that you know, nobody else really stepped up, and that's kind of the worst case scenario if you're a Bonnies fan, right? Because you know Matt Mobley is good, you know Jalen Adams is good. And in order for the team to actually, you know, threaten to win the conference or threaten to get an at-large bid, you need somebody else to step up. And that didn't happen in that game. I think I'm still kind of concerned about their front court play. Josh Ayeni is a really good jump shooter. He's a big guy. I think he's around 6'9", 200-something. But he doesn't really bang inside. He's got 13 rebounds this year. Only 7 of them are offensive. He doesn't block shots. Matt Mobley's been fantastic again. I think 56 points, 14 rebounds, 9 assists through their first 2 games. And, you know, if you're the Bonnies, you need somebody else to step up and sort of take the scoring load off of Matt Mobley or Jalen Adams. I'm really hoping that the Bonnies have Jalen Adams against Maryland on Friday so we can figure out who they actually are and how good they can actually be.
Number 2.
I've got Rhode Island, number 2. Rhode Island struggled on the road against the tough Nevada team. EC Matthews hurt his wrist in that game, which obviously hurts Rhode Island. He's their best player. It's the sort of thing that might be a blessing in disguise. Danny Hurley had a quote that I liked where he said it'll basically be like a free agent acquisition when they get him back, and it's tough to argue with. Because if any team is built to be able to withstand an injury to a great guard/forward like that, it's Rhode Island. Stan Robinson has 13 steals through his first 3 games. Rhode Island's turning over the opponent on over 25% of their possessions. That's 9th in the NCAA as of the time that we're talking about this. So last year, their defensive identity was they had that front court that blocked everything, right? Between Hassan Martin and Karan Iverson, Rhode Island's team block rate was one of the best in the country.
I mean, they were also jacked. They were like grown men at 20 years old.
Yes, they were. And it feels like their new defensive identity, instead of blocking shots, they're going to force a lot of turnovers. So Andre Berry's emerged as a front court player for them. Cyril Langevin got injured. So, you know, they've been running a lot of four guard, but then even their four guard lineup is big. I think their four guard lineup goes like 6 foot, 6'2", 6'4", 6'4", you know, something that's not very small. And when Matthews and Langevin then come back, they're going to have a lot of flexibility to go big and to go small. So I think, you know, Rhode Island's going to be, you know, a good team all season long.
Yeah, I watched EC Matthews play. He actually played at Kenner. And was on, I think, AJ's team, someone that I got to see a lot of him. The guy can all-out score. Now, is he a point guard? Is he a shooting guard? Do they have, like, a couple guards that bring the ball up?
Yeah, he's kind of a combo guard. I think it's mostly, Jared Terrell and, forgetting his first name right now, but the other guard, Garrett, I think they sort of split point guard duties. Haven't seen a whole lot of Rhode Island so far this year. But my impression is that EC Matthews is a little bit more off ball, a little bit more of a creator on the wing.
And you're king of the A-10.
king of the A-10 at the moment is Davidson. Davidson has been absolutely unreal to start the season. They've got a 150.3 offensive rating, which is just impossible, I think. If you look at the best offensive rating from each of the past 10 years or so, you generally don't get a whole lot higher than 120. So that's like they're just absolutely throwing flames right now. They've got 52 assists, only 7 turnovers. On defense, they've allowed 26 assists, and they've forced 26 turnovers. And then, you know, Peyton Aldridge is going nuts. John Axel Gunmanson has 43 points on 17 shots. I know that they've only played 2 games. I know that they haven't really played anyone yet. But this isn't really a we need to wait to see if they're good kind of situation. Like,
you really don't think so.
You don't do that 2 games in a row unless you're legitimately very, very good.
Because it has you have them now moving from 4th to 1st.
I'm moving from 3rd to 1st. I was one of the highest on them in the A-10 in the preseason, and I'm feeling vindicated right now and feeling, you know, quite frankly, a little bit silly for not having them even higher, because I was high on this team coming into the season, and the way that they've been running, you know, McKillick's sort of fever dream of an offense is just been unreal. They play Nevada tomorrow. I think that'll show us a lot about how well they can actually compete. If I had to make a prediction, I would say that Davidson, you know, I would predict Davidson to win. They also play UNC on December 1st, so they're gonna test themselves a little bit in the out of conference, and they're gonna let us know, you know, how good they actually are. But my opinion right now, as of this moment, is that, you know, you don't do what they did in the first 2 games without legitimately being a very, very good offensive team.
So Davidson is the week 2 king of the A-10, or king of the North.
Right.
Did you watch Game of Thrones?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
So if you're a listener, you know, another blogger, you know, you cover Davidson or you cover GW or whatever, and you want to come on the show, maybe you don't think that Petey Buckets is giving your team...
Who's Petey Duckets?
Yes. Yeah. Petey Buckets, I would like to hear you debate him. Come on our show. We would love to have you. I can Skype you in, no issues. If you disagree or you just want to hop on by, George, shoot us a message through Twitter. Our Twitter, again, is @ByGeorgeGMU. Pete, do you have any lasting thoughts for your millions of fans out there?
I think it'll be a fun season for Mason, man. I think the important thing is to keep expectations in check. You know, I'm bought in at this point to the line that it's a 2-year evaluation period basically for this season. I'm really looking forward to watching what AJ Wilson and Mar can do on the floor together. I think the offensive spacing is going to be tremendous. I think that we're going to probably be a little bit better offensively in terms of rating and efficiency than we were last year. Just because everybody, you know, aside from when Calix is on the floor, everybody else is going to have to be defended out to the 3-point line. And that creates an entirely different sort of pressure that defenses have a lot of trouble adjusting to.
So even though Petey can break down every single team in the A-10, you always know where his heart resides. Guys, thanks for listening to By George. Tune in next time.